PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. James Petras is my guest today. There's always so much to discuss with Jim, including getting into his new book, and I want to start off by mentioning that. It's called The Politics of Empire, the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East. And Jim, it's just another stellar performance by you. I started off my first line of writing about it saying, it's Petras at his best. Indeed it is, Jim. You just cover so much important ground. And before we went on air, you mentioned you wanted to discuss a review of what's going on in the region and so on. And let's begin by doing that.
Well, Steve, I think the focus of U.S. foreign policy over the last 20 years has been on the Middle East. And ostensibly, the idea behind the policy was that the U.S. Intervention in that region would lead to greater stability, democracy, and prosperity. And instead, as I survey the political situation there, I find that what U.S. intervention has resulted in is a gigantic prison. I just look at some of the principal allies of the United States in the region, the governments and countries where the U.S. has given greatest support, greatest engagement, and where it's most committed. First, we look at Egypt. U.S.-backed military junta has killed approximately 3,500 people, has several hundred under facing the death penalty, and over 15,000 political prisoners jailed since last June. We look further. Israel. Well, Israel has approximately 12,000 political prisoners, 99% of whom are Palestinians. But that's only the top of the iceberg. We have 1.5 million people living in Gaza in virtually an open-air prison, and they are subject to encirclement. They can't go fishing. They can't cross the line. They can't trade. All sorts of confinement, and we're talking about 1.5 million people. Then we have Saudi Arabia, which Obama recently visited, embraced the absolutist monarch, kissed them on both cheeks. And in Saudi Arabia, we have at least 30,000 known political prisoners. And then we have the Gulf states, Bahrain, Qatar, etc. We don't have exact figures, but those little statelets have hundreds of political prisoners. Now, I'm talking about political prisoners, people that don't pick up the gun. These are prisoners for beliefs, for peaceful protest, peaceful engagement in politics, electoral politics, etc. Then we have Iraq, a country which the U.S. invaded and occupied for the last 10 years. They claim a U.S. withdrawal, but the U.S. has military bases there. And the number of political prisoners is virtually unknown because so many of them are kept in secret confinement and in torture chambers. But I would guess that we have thousands of prisoners, at least, if not tens of thousands, in Iraq. Yemen, the same picture there, a country that's been ravaged by a despotism that Washington has given wholehearted support. Jordan, a close ally of the U.S. and Israel, also has several hundred, if not thousands, political prisoners. Then we have Turkey, who have the Turkish government under Erdogan has jailed thousands of journalists, demonstrators, and critics of the regime. Numbers vary from anywhere from 3,000 to 10,000 political prisoners in Turkey. And then we have Syria, which is engaged in an armed conflict largely at the behest of Western countries, organizing a mercenary army of invaders, many of them fundamentalists who've taken the leading role in attempting to overthrow the Syrian government. Now, the number of political prisoners here, it's difficult. Surely the Bashar Assad regime had jailed oppositionists and dissidents before the outbreak of the violence. We don't know the number of prisoners that are taken in the opposition, because they execute most of the people that are opposed to their Islamic terrorist politics. The Syrian government recently freed a number of its own political prisoners. So that's a very difficult case to broach. But overall, I think we get the picture. 20 years of U.S. intervention has turned the Middle East into a ravaged area, an area in which there is not a single democratic government, and a region which is totally polarized between the multi-billionaires in Israel and Saudi Arabia, etc., and the large mass of the working population, not to speak of oppressed minorities in each and every one of these countries. The net effect is we don't have peace, we don't have freedom, and we certainly don't have prosperity. And this has been at the cost of several trillion dollars in U.S. Government spending and the loss of lives and the hostility that has been generated. So when we look at the U.S. in the global context, we can say where it has focused the greatest amount of energy, money, personnel, and diplomacy, it's been an abysmal failure by its own criteria.
Jim, you're absolutely right, spot on everything. A line I like to use often is to say, wherever America shows up, mass slaughter, death, destruction, and human misery follow, and that certainly is true in the Middle East. There is absolutely nothing good that America has done for the region. But of course, you can look around the world and wherever America shows up, Jim, there certainly is nothing done for ordinary people. Wars, brutal exploitation, the worst of all possible things. And of course, there's so much going on at home where people are so terribly mistreated. And you covered it. You've read about it so often, and I do all the time. Just horrible things going on. And instead of things getting better, they get progressively worse.
Well, Steve, I think there's a connection here between the tremendous military damage and political repression that the U.S. has fostered abroad and the deteriorating situation at home. I think you can't channel that many resources, give so much focus to engaging in warfare and totalitarian regimes, and expect to be able to raise the living standards. Because as a consequence of these wars and interventions, U.S. business has been very reticent about investing. Who wants to go into Iraq or Egypt in the middle of all this bloodletting and instability and hostilities? So the fact of the matter is that the result of that is the U.S. Treasury is pillaging our taxpayers, neglecting our domestic social context, and channeling it into supporting overseas dictatorships. Not as if the U.S. population, through foreign aid, is aiding overseas people. No, foreign aid is impoverishing the U.S. public and enriching and supporting dictators abroad. And I think this is one of the fallacies that the U.S. justifies. Well, we have to sacrifice for the good of these poor people overseas. That is a lie. And I think the U.S. public realized it, because the polls, as I show in my book, overwhelmingly the U.S. public, by 2-to-1 margin, believes that we shouldn't be involved overseas. We should be focused on rebuilding the U.S. economy. Of course, that's not going to happen with this kind of government, Democrats and Republicans. They both take turns destroying the U.S. economy. But what I'm saying is that wars abroad are no longer profitable, at least not for the great majority of Americans. And I think that that connection is being made. However, it's not translating into anything except electoral abstention. People are disgusted with the Democrats and Republicans. They see through their lies. And what do? Is they don't vote. Well, in one sense, that's a good thing. It's a rejection, and it deprives the system of legitimacy. But it's not going to change anything. And until this discontent and the majority of American people take some kind of political, organized expression, I think this thing could continue going on and on.
Oh, indeed, Jim. This morning, for the first time, I had an interview on Russia, RT International, formerly Russia Today, now RT International. They had me on their Truth Seeker program. They pre-recorded a program that'll air on Sunday night, and they'll send me a link. I did about a 10-minute segment, and they got into the issue of what can people do. There's an initiative beginning today, in fact, a new wave initiative of sustained activism against the things that are going on at home, and I imagine the major issues affecting people in America will be brought up, including, you know, the bankrupt occupation of America, the waging wars that are benefiting nobody abroad or at home, the terrible things going on causing so much harm. So they're going to do this, and I was asked the question, you know, what do you think about this and what results can it have, and would you accept the possibility of confronting the beast of America violently versus nonviolently? And the last segment I did, the last question I was asked related to, you know, how do we handle this thing? What's the best way to handle it going forward? And I stress the point that the way to really bring about change is the way it's happened in America before. You need sustained activism. I don't believe in violence. I think violence only begets more violence, but you need to keep at them. And this was what the labor struggles were all about, and the civil rights struggles were all about, and the anti-slavery struggles. I guess there was some violence in there mixed in, but it was mostly nonviolent. Martin Luther King with the civil rights issue and a little bit on the anti-war issue. He certainly believed in nonviolence, but you gotta sustain the effort. You can't let it wane, and you can't win in a week or a month or a year. This struggle has to go on for years. It began in the 1950s, throughout the 1960s, to the middle of the 1960s, and the anti-Vietnam War activism from the mid-1960s well into the 1970s. And we had better people in Washington then, by far, than we have now. No saints for sure, Jim, but certainly not the likes, much different people than the likes of what we have today with the neocon hardliners and so on. But it took many years of struggle to get this kind of change to take place. And even when you win, you don't win unless you hold on to what you get. If you let the energy wane, you're going to steal it all back from you, which is exactly what's happened. But this was my answer. We need people power, Jim, going in the face of the power structure nonviolently and staying with it for the long haul.
Well, I think you have a valid point there, Steve. I think it's going to be the long march. Hopefully we'll be able to get a hold of some of the institutional positions that we can further the struggle from below. But I think we also have to face the fact that this whole issue of violence in politics is totally concentrated in the government. I mean, the violent intrusion into everyone's life through the huge spy apparatus of the NSA and the use of intelligence to frame people, to pursue them at their jobs, try to intimidate people. So you have, on the one hand, a vast spy operation. We have a presidential usurpation of executive powers and violation of the Constitution, including the possibilities of presidents assassinating American citizens. We have also the case that's been uncovered, CIA deeply involved in horrendous tortures. That's coming out of the U.S. Senate now, revelations that this was far more pervasive. So we have spying, we have usurpation of executive powers, we have the organized and systematic use of torture. So I think when people raise the issue of change, and I agree with you, we should use peaceful organizing and peaceful protests and peaceful electoral systems. But we have to realize the other side is not peaceful. It's violent. It violates constitutional and international norms. And I think we have to expose this, because the issue of violence that's raised is a crucial question, but it's all concentrated in the organized executive branch with congressional complicity. And I think people have to be absolutely clear that as we move forward on a social agenda, on political change, we have to expose this kind of state violence which tries to inhibit and block the process of change, and what the consequences of that may be in the future.
Well, indeed, Jim, and one thing I'd like to add to what I just said was, anyone who thinks they can go to the polls and elect new people to replace the ones who were there and think they're going to get something different than they have now are living in a dream world. It never happened before. It's not happening now. It won't happen in the 2014, the mid-year elections, or the 2016 elections.
Well, Steve, elections. The judicial rulings that say that billionaires can invest as much money in buying parties, buying candidates, determining who the nominees are going to be, what their program is going to be. Now there's absolutely no limit. The last election, before this ruling, the Republicans and Democrats, Obama and Romney, spent nearly $2 billion in trying to buy voters. And I think now all the constraints are off. The idea that this is an oligarchy, a plutocratic oligarchy, has never been clearer. The latest figures I've seen is 60% of the funding for campaigns comes from about 1% of the electorate. 1% of the contributors contribute over 60% to campaign funding, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So there's no way we can talk about electoral politics in a democracy. We're dealing with a clearly scientifically defined oligarchy, and the Supreme Court has simply given this legal veneer to say, well, it's legal, and they have the gall to call this freedom of speech. In other words, a billionaire buying presidential candidates and congressional candidates and political parties is free speech. This is the most perverse judicial ruling I've ever read in my life anywhere.
Jim, it really is, and I have an article written on this. I haven't been able to get it out because I've had too many pressing ones to get out at the same time, and I can't get them all out at the same time. But I titled my article, Supreme Court Rules for Big Money. You know, $1 equals one vote, Jim. You know, you and I have one vote, and the billionaires get a billion votes. Indeed.
Well,
I think it was the Center for Responsive Politics said something like 589, less than 600 major donors contributed $3.1 billion to the 2012 electoral cycle, $3.1 billion. You know, 6 million of us, Jim, we couldn't contribute a fraction of that.
That's true, Steve, and it's going to get worse with this congressional hearing. We saw that the gambling mogul, Adelson,
yes,
in Las Vegas, had the Republican candidates come out and listen to him. He is the fellow that called for a nuclear bomb falling on Tehran at a public meeting.
Indeed.
And he is going to be the deciding factor in becoming who's going to fund the major candidates in the Republican Party. And when one of the candidates, Christie, the governor of New Jersey, mentioned in a speech in front of Adelson that he's 100% for Israel because he took a helicopter flight over the occupied territories. Now listen, here's a fellow that spent his whole life backing Israel and whatever issues come up. But he slipped on his linguistics. He actually spoke the truth that Palestine is militarily occupied by Israel. He immediately was chastised and threatened with getting cut out of the nominating process because Adelson didn't like that wording. He immediately prostrated himself and apologized profusely and said it was terrible what he said and what he did and he didn't mean it, etc. But this kind of financial power dictating not only agendas but even the way in which the prostate and prostitute politicians express themselves. They have to have a ventriloquist telling them exactly what words to use in what way in order to defend the interests of their benefactors.
Oh, indeed, Jim, at that same conference in Las Vegas, Dick Cheney spoke, and I wrote about it in one of my articles. He endorsed the idea of Israel bombing Iran and got a loud a volume of response of applause in response. Those are the kind of characters that run America, Jim. The kind of people we need. We need the sustained activism to rouse them out and get some decent people replacing them.
Yes, and I think the source of the funding, the gambling casinos and all that's associated with them and how many people become addicted to gambling and their families break up and they engage in fraud and their businesses and drug addiction, gambling addiction, mental disorders, etc. I personally am opposed to all of these casinos because basically they're a way of further polarizing the society. The house always wins. That's a cliche. And the casino workers become kind of the employees of this huge, huge suction that goes from the lower middle class to the upper class. And I think that's the nature of these casinos. Now, the politicians talk about it as a source of jobs and taxes, but the social consequences are enormously costly to the taxpayer. So what they gain in terms of tax revenue from the casinos, they lose in terms of the loss of jobs, loss of work time, loss of health, family breakups, etc. If you do a cost-benefit analysis, even in the most material way, leaving aside the moral and social implications, these are cancers on the body politic.
Jim, the same thing is true about public money to build a sports stadia and subsidies for corporations to locate their headquarters in certain cities. Countless millions, maybe billions across the country are literally thrown away, handing it to these predators instead of putting the money into the local economies and benefiting the people who live there. And the idea that there are benefits to ordinary people from all these things going on is another one of the things I call a big lie. They don't benefit ordinary people at all. They harm them.
Well, yeah, if a company gets all these concessions from the public in terms of the costs of operation, the public should also get a share of the profits. So
indeed,
if you get a $100 million concession, the public, when the enterprise becomes profitable, the public should get a percentage of those profits. Because they made the investment. Same thing goes with a baseball stadium. They build a stadium, they should say, well, we're going to get 50% of the receipts from the revenue of this company. But no, the public subsidizes the private enterprise, and the private enterprise keeps the profit. So it's a no-lose situation, Steve.
It is, Jim. It is a very rotten, corrupted system. And again, it's a system that just has to change at some point. I don't know that you and I will live long enough to see it, Jim, but it's a system that I think over a long enough period of time just has to be self-destructive. How can you do so much harm to so many people for so long until the entire thing just blows up because people are in such dire straits they simply won't take it anymore? And that's what revolutions are made of.
Well, I think whatever revolution will happen as a result of small victories on a day-to-day basis. I think people need to have confidence that they can struggle and win, whether it's on the shop floor, in the workplace, whether it's in a community that defeats initiatives to give big tax concessions or incinerators in the poor people's neighborhoods. I think all of these small struggles begin to create a self-confidence and it's a training school for organization. So I think the revolution might be the long-term consequences of accumulation of all these small-time, small-scale victories, whether it's a school strike in Chicago against closing of public schools, strengthening neighborhood organizations that can look beyond the Democratic machine or the Republican plutocrats that run City Hall. I think we need to see victories even on a small scale and on a local level. And I think it could build from the local to the state and regional and on to the national level. I think it's a mistake to start just at the top. I think one of the problems with Ralph Nader's campaigns wasn't his program. In fact, I voted for him, but that he never built anything on the bottom. It was all Nader and his campaign, and when he finishes the campaign, he goes home, and all the voters that voted for him are abandoned. And I think this is a strategic weakness of running electoral campaigns from the top rather than electoral campaigns growing from social organizations that engage in local struggles and hook up to the national campaign as a kind of platform for organizing at the national level, rather than looking at it strictly as an educational campaign and pressuring the two major parties, which I think Nader was really intent on, was influencing the left wing of the Democratic Party and thinking that he would have some kind of lasting effect. And I think that was not the case.
Well, there might have been a left wing to the Democratic Party years ago, Jim. There certainly isn't much of it now. Maybe a few people spotted in the Congress. But basically, the Democrats and Republicans are two sides of the same coin, as I like to put it. I mean, you can see what they support. The basic stuff they're in lockstep on. I mean, wars and corporate empowerment and all the police state laws that get passed. I mean, the parties are absolutely, totally, 100% in sync with each other. Neoliberal harshness. I despise the political system, Jim, because it's money controlled, and I think the only way to get real change is to go outside of that system with sustained nonviolent activism. I think that's what's got to happen. But how do you motivate people to do it? It's a very tough thing to do.
Well, the people are realizing this, Steve, right there in Chicago and Los Angeles. The whole Mexican-American, Latin-American immigrant population, recent citizens, etc., They're going to abstain in droves. Many of them were fooled by Obama. Obama turned around, took their votes, mouthed some cliches about immigration reform, and has expelled 2 million, 2 million immigrants from this country, more than all the presidents combined in American recent history. And
this is shocking.
This has provoked the great majority of immigrant peoples, their relatives who are citizens and others, to say, no more con man. And I think the Democratic hustlers, the Mexican-American and Asian-American vote hustlers that run the city councils and the mayors, they have been discredited also. And I think that what the reaction, typical reaction in America to betrayal has been abstention. And I think this is the hottest nut to crack, to create the idea of an alternative that's worth going to the polls for, worth going and organizing at the precinct level, because they get so, people get so disgusted with Obama. They think he stinks like the worst sewers in the city. And yet, this paralyzes them. So, no, don't bother me. I'm going to watch my favorite television program, or my I'm going to watch the Chicago Cubs rather than going out and voting against these Democratic hustlers.
Absolutely, Jim. I'm afraid we're out of time, and we sure didn't talk about your book, but I want to stress, again, the title is The Politics of Empire, the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East. And, Jim, it really is a magnificent, magnificent book. You cover so much ground, and you go beyond the Middle East. Just vital issues. I was so impressed in reading the book, Jim. You know, I wrote about it, and I simply couldn't stop talking about the things that you wrote, because you covered so much important ground. I so strongly recommend to listen that they get a copy of your book. It's brand new. It's easily gotten through Clarity Press. Go on Amazon. Simple to get. I absolutely love the book. I'm going to read it a second time. And it's vital. It's important stuff. Anybody who reads this book is going to come away with a lot more knowledge than they had before they read it, Jim. And I absolutely wanted to stress that.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it, especially coming from a sharp critic like yourself.
Oh, well, I think I tell the truth, Jim. I can't think of anything else.
I must say one thing, and that is some of the basic ideas that went into that book came from reading your daily articles.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's just say that.
Well, I'm very impressed, and I thank you, Jim. I look forward to getting you back next month.
Okay,
Steve, we'll be back on Sunday.
Next month.
We'll be on live on Sunday. Make it a regular habit.
Okay, Steve. Good night.